Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
I'm joined by Fabian Nicieza. He is the author of the brand new novel, The Self-Made Widow. The title itself is kind of funny, just to even think about that scenario, but the book's available everywhere. Fabian, jumping into this, I know this is a follow-up on your previous book, and it's one of these books that kind of makes you, it's the topic, the theme is a serious one, but it makes me chuckle as I read it. Can you kind of set this up for us going in?
Well, going in, it follows a year after the events of Suburban Dicks, my debut novel, and the introduction to Andy Stern, who is a New Jersey mother of five currently. She should have been an FBI profiler, but the birth of that first child, followed by many more, derailed her from what had been her desire. A murder in her small town of West Windsor, New Jersey, in the first book, propels her to start being who she always should have been. And joining her in helping her solve the crime is someone she's known since childhood, a reporter named Kenny Lee, who himself isn't what he should have been, because in college he won a Pulitzer Prize for a journalism story that basically toppled the administration of the New Jersey government. And then 10 years later, as we start Suburban Dicks, he's working at a weekly local suburban newspaper, and all of it is his own fault. In a lot of ways, he crashed and burned. So each of them have something to prove and something to redeem and reclaim in their lives, and they do for the most part through the course of Suburban Dicks. So setting that up in The Self-Made Widow is a situation where Kenny is very happy and working in New York City on a documentary based on the nonfiction book he wrote called Suburban Secrets of the events of Suburban Dicks. It is a snake eating its own tail a little bit here. And Andy, meanwhile, has an 11-month-old child. Things at home have stabilized a little. Her relationship with her husband, which has never been good for the duration of their marriage, is a little more stable. And the husband of one of her close friends passes away overnight of a heart attack. And it's natural causes, because he had a pre-existing heart condition that his doctors all verify, and many of Andy's friends knew about, but Andy didn't. And for some reason, she can't quite put her finger on. She thinks that this isn't kosher. She thinks that there may be a murder here. And for the first half of the book, the question she needs to be asking and others ask of her is there really a murder here? Or is it you trying to create one in order to keep yourself in the chase, in the hunt, and feeling alive? And Andy, being an incredibly stubborn person, doesn't think that she is doing it for those reasons. She thinks she's doing it because her friend Molly is a killer. And little by little, as the truth starts to come out, it begins to affect the relationships between the friends, the relationships within Andy's marriage and her friends' marriages. And through that, we explore the themes of marriage and suburbia, the notion of our Groundhog Day existence, of the repetitiveness of our routines, and ultimately the question we ask ourselves sometimes out here in the wilds of the suburbs, is this all there is to life? And I think that the themes get reflected through the course of the book and ultimately lead to the exciting opportunity for status quo changes for Andy and to a certain extent for Kenny as well.
This idea of a death that may or may not be a murder, it seems like a very Hitchcockian type of a trope to use. Was there a little bit of an element of that? Because that's worked so well through literature and film throughout the years. Is that kind of what you had in mind going on, that, well, maybe, maybe not?
Well, you know, if it is, it's probably subconscious, quite honestly. The real reason I did it is because in her introductory novel, she is incredibly driven, incredibly capable, confident, at least in her investigative abilities, and she's always certain in her mind that she knows more than everyone else around her. I'm not saying she's Captain America. I'm not saying she's this flawless hero or main character. I think both my main characters have a lot of flaws to them, and I enjoy that about them, and I think a lot of the readers certainly seem to enjoy that about them in the first book. I wanted to set up a scenario where Andy had to question herself because others were questioning her, and set up a scenario where, what if there's a possibility, as a reader, you're reading and you're thinking, what if there's not a murder here? What if she is, you know, pushing it when she doesn't need to be? But the other side of the coin is, what if there is a murder here and the character who you now think is smarter than everyone else in the room is struggling to figure it out? And that is what really appealed to me for doing this, is because it put my main character in a situation where the reader can begin to question her infallibility.
So many characters are out there in literature now, in novels, that are investigators of some type, whether it's a cop or a detective, private detective, working for the city, whatever. So when you go to create a character like Andy, or even like Kenny, the journalist, how do you go about making them distinct from just your average run-of-the-mill investigators? What traits do you give them that make them stand out so they're not just another Harry Bosch, or they're not just another whatever character?
Well, for me, it's twofold. The first of which is an incredible cheat on my part. I didn't read a lot of mystery books growing up. I didn't read a lot of mystery books when I originally came up with the idea for this first novel, which was in 1995. And I had the idea for the second novel just a few years later, because it was predicated on the unexpected death of a close friend of mine of a heart condition that none of us knew he had. And he died at a young age. I made him the same age as Derek Good, who passes away in the book at 43 years old. The ideas and the germs for the books were not necessarily predicated upon the tropes of mystery fiction. They were predicated upon events happening in my real life that I extrapolated into fiction. Mostly it's because it's my brain's way of trying to cope with things that are tough to cope with. And because I didn't read all that kind of a lot of that detective fiction, I didn't know a lot of the character tropes. Since then, I've read all of the Connelly Bosch books. I've read a lot of the Louise Penny books. I've read a lot more Ivanovich and Grafton than I had before. So I'm seeing the differences in the characters that you're mentioning, and enjoying how writers approach those differences. So for me, it was really about trying to create two characters who yearn to find the truth. And they think that in finding the truth about whatever the mystery of the story is, it's somehow going to help them reveal a truth about themselves. And by revealing the truth about themselves, they hope it's going to advance them forward. But because they're both, you know, kind of flawed characters who make a lot of mistakes and are both kind of socially awkward, it's a challenge for them to navigate the process in a way that we think of as being socially acceptable. But that's the trope of a lot of these characters as I'm reading. There is an outsider, a loner, a driven aspect to the nature of what investigators have to do to solve a crime. I even try to reflect that in The Self-Made Widow, when Andy has conversations with her oldest daughter, Ruth, who is trying to learn and understand her mother, and has her own inklings and kind of leanings towards a curiosity in this whole idea of being an investigator. But her mother sets her a little straight on the lonely aspect of it, the difficult, challenging aspect of it, because often finding out truths that have been hidden are hidden because people don't want them revealed. And in revealing them, you can create a lot of turmoil and a lot of trouble, which certainly is the case in The Self-Made Widow.
I'm chatting with Fabian Nyziessa about his brand new novel, The Self-Made Widow. It's available everywhere. Fabian, is there a certain advantage you get to setting this in suburbia versus a big town, a New York City, a Washington, D.C., a Los Angeles? There's some stuff you can do that you can't do elsewhere?
Well, first of all, again, I'm old now, so I like to cheat as much as I can. If I was 35, I'd make work a lot harder for myself, but I like to cheat, so I live in the area where I set the books. I've lived in this area for 30 years, so I know it intimately. I don't have to do as much research to know what's down the road on Route 1, what stores are are in the in the shopping mall, where the supermarkets are, all of that kind of stuff. So it simplifies my process because I know my area, so I can create scenes set in those areas, and I'm comfortable in describing them, and I'm comfortable in having the characters move around them. Honestly, the reason I included a lot of events happening in Manhattan in the second book, and having Kenny work in Manhattan now, is because Manhattan has been a part of my life for my entire life, quite frankly, because when we immigrated to this country, we lived in Queens for the first few years, and then after we moved to New Jersey because of my dad's work, we still went into Manhattan at least two times a month, often three times a month on weekends, because my parents were city people. They grew up, they were born and raised in Buenos Aires, so they loved the city. So I worked in Manhattan since 1983 when I graduated college, and I worked at Berkeley Publishing, and then I worked at Marvel Comics, and then I worked freelance with a company in Manhattan called Starlight Writer Entertainment, and I would go in at least 2 days a week as a freelance writer. So it's ingrained in me also, and I wanted to set stuff in there in the second book. But ultimately, I hope that another benefit of setting it in suburbia is that it creates a comfort level with readers who can see of themselves in the book, in the characters, in the events, in the stories, not necessarily the murder, but the idea of the train commute into work every day, the idea of the supermarket aisles being clogged and the supermarkets changing where the food locations are every 2-3 weeks, those kind of vexing, annoying things that just are part and parcel of your daily routine in the suburbs.
You talked about Marvel Comics, and in looking through what you've done, there's hardly a character that you haven't touched in some way with Marvel over the years. Is that a fair statement?
That is a fair statement. I believe that I've written just about every single major A-lister, B-lister, and C-lister at Marvel and DC over the last 35 years, and when I got to write a Black Panther story a couple of years ago for a custom comic Marvel redoing, Black Panther and Thor were the last two characters that I had not written from the Marvel Silver Age in the 60s, which is when I first started reading comics. And as a result, I've basically written either the title or the character in a book of every single major Marvel character that I grew up reading as a kid. That's totally kind of cool. And it's an ingrained part of my life. It always has been and always will be. It's a part of my life and my career that I'm incredibly proud of. So getting to write books later on in my career is really fun for me, and I'm enjoying doing it a lot, and I'm enjoying the prose format a lot. But I don't do it to the exclusion of one platform or another. I've always been a writer that will do anything that interests me that I think I can do well, or at least decently well, and comics remain an important part of that aspect.
As a writer, what's more difficult, jumping into a character who's been written for years, kind of like a jump rope that's going, or creating a character like Andy out of whole cloth?
That's a great question. It really is. And unfortunately, I don't know if it's fair for me to be able to answer it, because I've written ongoing Marvel characters and DC characters for 30 years that were characters I'd grown up reading since I was 6-7 years old. So I had a familiarity with them and an understanding of who they were before I had even started writing them. And as a result, it wasn't jumping in whole cloth. It was almost like jumping in with a comfortable blanket already wrapped around you. By the same token, you're reading Suburban Dicks in 2021, or you're reading Self-Made Widow in 2022, and I created those characters in 1995. And then I had the entire first book broken down in my head, and the characters in 1995. I had the second book broken down in my head just a few years later. It took me a long time to write them for a wide variety of reasons, but they'd already been percolating and existing in my head for almost 20 years, I think, before I started writing them. So even then, it wasn't jumping in whole cloth. It wasn't creating something from scratch. So I'm not quite there yet. A lot of times writers the ideas that they develop, the ideas you get to see, are not things they just came up with a year ago. You know, they might have been sitting on them for a long time. I'm working on a middle reader graphic novel development right now, and even though I'm fleshing it out for the first time in the last few months, it's still an idea I've had for well over 5 years, you know? So I almost don't look forward to the idea of confronting that question. I don't want to do the extra work that comes from creating it full cloth from scratch. It sounds daunting to me right now.
All right. Well, you're an incredibly talented writer on a variety of platforms. This new book is great. It's The Self-Made Widow. It is the latest novel from Fabian Nicieza. It's available everywhere. Go check out his Marvel Comics stuff and read Suburban Dicks as well if you haven't read that. Fabian, just a fantastic book, and I thank you for joining me to talk about it.
I appreciate the time, Brian. Thank you very much.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcasts. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time.